Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here. I want to tell you about a benefit show that we're doing for our friend Jason Sines. He had a horrible accident and is currently fighting his butt off to recover. So the benefit show is they're going to be in Los Angeles and New York City Monday, April 1st. That, of course, is April Fool's Day in honor of the very punny, funny, goofy Jason Sines. And in Washington, D.C., there is going to be a benefit show on Wednesday, April 3rd. If you want all of the details, just look in the description of today's Side Stories episodes and you'll find who's performing. Obviously, Jackie's going to perform. I'm performing with Holden McNeely here in New York City. Ed Larson is going to be there. The whole Last Podcast family will be fighting for Jason Sines the best we know how through using humor on both coasts of this fine country of ours. So please, if you have those nights off, check out those shows. It's not just going to be some boring, oh my God, sappy event. It's going to be full of laughs, full of joy, and quite frankly, it'll be nice to spend another evening with our LPN family. So, all right, everyone, come on out, support Jason Sines, support a friend of ours, and don't forget, hail yourselves!
There's no place to escape to.
This is the Last Podcast.
On the left.
Side Stories!
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
Side Stories. Yes. So I am in Toronto, Canada. Oh, yeah. I tell you what, it hasn't changed.
Very nice.
Oh, it hasn't changed.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know the Toronto exactly the same.
No, there's not my, Jamaican. It's not, that is a Jamaican accent.
Better? It's getting better. Oh, eh. Oh, you come up to Canada, eh.
You are exhausted.
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Side Stories. I am Benjamin Grant Kissel, the BGK.
Ooh.
And then, of course, we have Henry Zebrowski, who, after this tour, I had a chance to sleep on Sunday evening, and Henry Zebrowski has not. So he is what one would call in the clouds mentally.
I am destroyed. But I've had a couple of funny things happen to me. So I went from, we did our show in Pittsburgh. Holy shit, that whole tour was so much goddamn fun.
So much fun. And Pittsburgh, man, I cannot stress this enough. It is the, and I don't even want to plug it because I don't want to ruin it, but it is the unsung coolest city in America. And I'm not
really
even
is.
Being hyperbolic. I think Pittsburgh is so freaking fun. It's ridiculous. But all that Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Nashville all are beautiful.
We had a wonderful time. We had a sad, not sad. We didn't have a sad night. Cincinnati was having a sad night. Not for us, but people were crying in the street. I don't know why people are crying in the street in Cincinnati. I know what's going on, but we got plenty drunk at that. I think it's technically a terrible bar, but it was great.
Yeah.
Like, O'Malley's in the alley.
Yeah, that was it. I think we've already discussed this, but at one point we would just walk into this bar and then a fan wonder, so thank you for listening, but she was just bawling,
right.
And then she's like, it's so good to see you, but then I don't even know why they were crying, and then the whole thing, there was just a lot of hot drama going on in Cincy.
There was a lot of drama going on in the streets of Cincy.
But now you're in Toronto, and you're doing press for your Pretty Faces Going to Hell.
We went straight from Pittsburgh to Chicago to do C2E2. Because we're pushing Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell, which opens up season 4, starts again on Adult Swim on May 3rd. I'm saying this even against my will. It is now so ingrained into my mouth muscles that I'm just saying it. But we went to Chicago, and then I went to Toronto, and I did press all day for Toronto. And so what'd they do? They're like, one of the big things in the middle of the day, we're doing Canadian morning television, the morning news. And they all said, Henry, please, first of all, you need to control yourself. And I was like, what are you talking about? Because each one, they all started with it. They all started with the warning. They're like, Henry, we need you to keep it to talking about the makeup and the costumes.
Okay.
That's it. And I was like, you trying to control me?
It sounds like they are.
Me?
It sounds like they are.
For good reason. I understand why they want to do it, but at the same time, you're paying for me to do the fucking thing, right? I'm going to go out there and I got to be too real. To be cast again. That's what I have to be.
I know your methodology.
And so I'm answering pretty normal questions. And finally, I ended up getting them very upset with me because I said at some point, which I'm certain is going to be cut out, where they was asking me, every one of them asked the same question of like, what's too naughty or raunchy to be on the show? And
these Toronto radio hosts, they want you to go there by saying, what's too naughty? What had to be cut out of your pretty face is going to hell. And then you answered their question. Is that correct?
You got to. They asked me to do it. And so I think was a funny peccadillo about network like bullshit with stuff like, you can pee on a man's face, but the pee can't be yellow. And you can shit. You can shit in a man's mouth. You can't. Shit can hit my lips. Shit can splat against the wall. You could see a pile of shit. I was saying poop, but I was saying poop, right? Okay. Because it's morning television.
You did clean it up then. You did
clean
it up.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah. I was clean. I thought I was clean.
Yeah.
But it can't be brown. And also the shit can't come out of a butt. So like you can't see the butt. And it was minutes of silence.
Right.
They were horrified, and everyone was just like, and I just go like, what? Like, I just explained it, and we're all the cameras on me. It's not live. So they're going to cut it out, I imagine. I don't know what they're going to do, but afterwards, they're like, we said to keep it to the costumes.
But they asked you. They asked you to go there.
Because guess what? We really do cut out. There's shit that we obviously is much worse than that.
Of course.
It's us in devil costumes.
It is bizarre that you can't show the brown poops, of course, because that's technically much healthier than a green one or an orange one.
What colors were your shit at the end of this trip?
Because
none of us shit. I'm still having problems because I'm still on the road.
The audience does not need to hear about post-tour Duke. I'll tell you that much. A little bit later on in this episode, actually coming up fairly quickly in this episode, we are going to speak with Joe Bob Briggs. He is
a television
legend. Joe Bob's Drive-In Theater, Monster Vision. He also was a correspondent on The Daily Show for 2 years. And he wrote the books, Joe Bob Goes to the Drive-In, and Joe Bob Goes Back to the Drive-In. So we are going to interview him coming up here in the very near future.
We're doing a long-form interview with him.
Yes.
It's just such a delight to talk to him. And normally we've been doing these interviews for Patreon, but we're like, Joe Bob Briggs is too big of a deal for us and for our community to just like, we wanted him front and center. We want you guys to hear what he has to say. And
Absolutely. Man,
he's still as sharp and as funny as ever.
Oh, he's great. And if you want to, this is also just a little bit of like, what do these two guys sound like when they interview someone? This is going to be a great sample for you, a great indication of how a show like that goes. So if you want more of those interviews, feel free to give $1 to our Patreon, $5, $1,000, or $1 million, and we'll take you to Six Flags.
We're taking you to Six Flags.
And then you can listen to we must have 15 to 20 interviews on there at this point, and they're all absolutely wonderful with great, great guests. First, I just want to read a couple of fun little stories. We can do a few here. This one is one of the personal favorites of mine, and I'm not sure how old Henry is, because this sounds like what is going to happen to Henry Zebrowski as soon as he is shoved into a retirement community by whatever children he has.
I am. You know I'm 34.
I know. You have some time.
I got 10 more years.
An elderly couple sued for blasting Iron Maiden too loud. An elderly couple who lived in a quiet retirement community in Stockholm, Sweden, which, by the way, we will be in Stockholm, has reportedly been sued for blasting Iron Maiden too loud. The couple used the English heavy metal band's music to take revenge on a new couple that moved into their neighborhood. Other neighbors say the issue started in October when the new neighbors arrived and their sex life was too loud. Apparently, the new couple would go at it, quote, all night. Just a reminder, this is a retirement community. So what is going on? Number one, kudos to both of these couples, where it's like you're banging too loud, and then the other couple is like, we know what to do. We're going to rock them out of here.
The best way to win in this scenario is to go over there and just straight up say, nice fucking.
So the couple, they're 81 years old and 71 years. They say old in the article, but I'm going to say young because they're still rocking the Maiden.
They are old.
They were not happy with the sounds of sex, so they started blasting the music, and it got so bad the police were called and had to force their entrance to the house while Avoiding to Shoot Strangers was playing, which I will say.
Hell yeah, man. That's a good fucking album.
If your house is being busted down by cops, the song Afford afraid to shoot strangers is played might actually be good, because maybe they'll be like, that's right, we are afraid to shoot strangers. We'll let the couple live.
I think, again, always revert to masturbating. If you want to get people's attention, you want to get them to leave you alone. If you're in the middle of a fight and you want it to stop, a really good way is to just start jerking off and then the fight stops. If you want them to go, you just say like, yeah. I like the way that she went, oi, 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 oi. If you can mimic the exact noises, that makes the other person then eventually, every time they try to have sex and they make the noises, they're going to think of the old couple just listening and rubbing each other.
Yeah, that is one way to do it. So that's just a little tale coming from Stockholm, Sweden, and we will see you all very soon. Also, you might like this one. Shoppers report seeing a ghost roaming the aisles of a Massachusetts grocery store. The name of the grocery store is Market Basket.
Where is Market Basket?
I have never heard of that before. Market Basket, I don't know. It's in Massachusetts.
All right.
So apparently, people are seeing, several people have reported seeing a young woman between the ages of 17 and 30, which is, it's quite an age gap, I would say, don't you think?
It is.
17 and 30 with light skin, dark hair, and blue eyes in out-of-fashion clothing wandering the aisles of Market Basket on Main Street. One shopper, according to Patch.com, is familiar with her as she used to visit her home when she lived near the store. This is according to the one shopper. She says, if the rumors are true, it makes this Market Basket a lot more interesting.
It just sounds like hipsters.
It could be.
That is just hipsters. That's how they all dress. They all dress in old-timey clothes.
I know. The woman goes on to say, I saw her and looked away to see if anyone else saw her. And when I looked back, she was gone.
That's so funny. It's like, I just want to always cut to the Ghostbusters scene of, get her. That was your plan, Ray? Get her?
Get her. Other customers are not believers. They are asking, what are you smoking? Which is, of course, a reference to marijuana. Marijuana doesn't make you see ghosts. As a matter of fact, marijuana probably would make you run frantically and forget that you ever saw anything paranormal because it's too horrifying to comprehend at that time.
Not me, man. I think that I legitimately would not be. I think I would be more ready to accept it.
Yeah. Could be. It could be as well. What are you smoking? It could go either way. That's the power of marijuana. Even employees of this place are divided. A woman who has worked in the grocery store for 4 years, she says, I don't want to lull if you're totally serious. But she does say she believes the store is definitely haunted, although admits the overnight shift makes his imagination run wild after working alone for 10 hours straight. So, Henry, you are currently exhausted. If you see a ghost right now, sadly, we're all going to have to take it through our skeptic group in our minds and be like, was he just tired?
It's quite possible. I tell you what, I am getting those trails.
I see
little things in the corners of my eyes.
Okay, you desperately need to fall asleep. You're recording in your hotel room in Toronto. I see the bed right behind you. Just jump right in there when we're done recording and do not get out until 5 minutes before you have to be somewhere.
Well, also, I thought that weed was legal in Canada, right? So I went and I just bought some. I went to a store and I bought some.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, people are telling me, being like, yeah, well, you know, weed is only mail order. You got to order it online. So there's no way you can get it yet. So but I was
Wait,
like,
what?
Uh-oh. I have a lot of it.
What did you buy then?
It's weed.
But they.
I smoked it last night.
Why would it only be mail order?
It's Canada, man.
I love the Canadian people, but sometimes you hear our Canadian law and you're just like, what? But why?
What does that even mean?
What does it mean,
mail order? Am I going to get a catalog? Is that what I'm doing?
So those are just a couple of my favorite little fun, lighthearted stories that were submitted by the listeners. So thank you all so much for submitting. Again, it's asidestoriesLPOTL@gmail.com. We love you and we love the stories. Thank you so much.
We do. It means a lot, honestly. And we'll be going through more mail next week. We're going to have, after this week, we have one more episode of the Deep Dive Last Podcast on the left, and then we're going to have Marcus again in 2 weeks.
Yes, cannot wait.
This podcast is brought to you by Devil May Cry 5, an over-the-top action-filled game rated M for mature, now available on Xbox One. Ever need to just slice and dice some demons while looking hella nice? This is the game for you. It features three demon hunters, each with unique playstyles, but don't just take our word for it. Bleeding Cool calls it an elegant symphony of obliteration. Dual Shockers call it one hell of a good time, and Game Rant calls Devil May Cry the perfect action game. So come on and kick some demon ass with Devil May Cry 5. And remember, games play best on Xbox One. And now it is time for a frickin' fantastic interview with Mr. Joe Bob Briggs. Are you ready to do this, Mr. Zabrowski? You ready to do this interview?
I want to talk to him.
Okay.
I want to talk to him.
Okay, make sure you
talk
to him.
Just me and him. I want to see a load of him. I want to see his home. I want to go and I want to smell his bathroom.
I don't think that's what we should be telling him.
I want to smell your bathroom, Mr. Briggs. Don't worry. I'm good for it.
Well, make sure you listen to the whole interview to hear if Henry asked that question, because I hope that he doesn't. We will see what happens.
A lot of people hope I don't say a lot of things.
Apparently everyone who works in Toronto radio was hoping that you didn't say any of that stuff. Although I will say once again, as an interviewer, you queue up a question, expect the question to be answered. So if you don't want Henry to go far,
questions.
Yeah, don't ask.
Don't ask me questions.
I know. All right, everyone, enjoy this interview with Joe Bob Briggs.
Live from your grave.
Literally, my liver has aged so hard in the last week because you're just on the road. I'm sure you understand, just traveling the country, especially on the convention route.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's just different hotel bar after different hotel bar.
Yeah, well, I do the cons and I do the, I have a one-man show that I do in a lot of cities. So, yeah, I'm on the road a lot. The thing about Toronto is they've got Cronenberg and they've got some really bad stuff from the 80s.
Yes.
But they have this thing there called, you know, where they'll talk to you about Canadian horror. Mm-hmm. Like it's a thing. And these movies, I don't know whether they're Canadian or American or whatever. But the Canadians always know which movies were actually filmed in Canada and which movies have Canadian directors and which movies have Canadian actors. And to me, they're all just the same.
Yeah.
But we'll always do this thing about what do you think of Canadian horror?
I don't know.
There's probably the same percentage of Canadian horror movies as there are a percentage of Canadians in North America. So,
right.
They are so excited and so particular about claiming their legacy because they hate being swallowed by America.
Absolutely. Well, I come from my home state is Wisconsin, and any celebrity that comes from Wisconsin, that is the first thing that people will say. As a matter of fact, little known fact, because she has said, kind of denounced my home state, Halle Berry, originally from Wisconsin, but you wouldn't know it if you listened to her. You have to talk to a Wisconsinite who was like, technically Catwoman was ours.
Well, Ed Gein is definitely yours.
Oh, I know.
Oh, yeah.
We claim him. We got Dahmer, we got Gein, and we got Chris Farley. So Wisconsin has a pretty good track record of entertainers.
That's right.
Joe Bob, are you excited to be talking to two more like fat-bodied, ugly men? Does this excite you?
Well, that's a great thing about podcasting.
You don't have to see us. I love it. So, Joe Bob, I got to ask you first, because obviously you are the king of B-movies. It's a special niche. A B-movie, like a Reanimator, there has to be something about it that it can't be so bad you can't watch it, but it can't be too good that the Oscars would even consider looking at it as a mainstream film. What makes the perfect B-movie?
Well, first of all, I don't like to call them B-movies. I call them exploitation movies, and that's because, you know, back in the 80s, somebody came out with a book called King of the Bees, and one of the guys in the book was Roger Corman. And I saw Roger right after the book came out. And I said, Roger, what do you think about being called one of the kings of the bees? And he said, I don't really like that. And I said, why? And he says, because it implies that there's an A movie and a B movie and my movies aren't as good as the A movies.
Right.
I said, what do you think about being called the king of exploitation? And he said, I love that. And, and it's because, you know, the movies that we call exploitation films or genre films, they're not necessarily worse than the Hollywood films.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes they're much better.
Right.
A movie like Hellraiser is, in my opinion, better than a big budget movie like, you know, like The Exorcist 3.
It is. That is for certain, except for I do love the continuation of The Preacher.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has its moment. And is that the one with George C. Scott? I think it is.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
So, yeah, it does have its features. But for all that money, you know, they did more with no money when they made, you know, Hellraiser. So, but I think what it used to be easy to tell because these movies would only play the drive-ins and the grindhouses, you know, but today when everything is released on, you know, various types of digital media, it's basically, the ones that are considered beneath contempt by the remaining mainstream critics out there, of which there are a few.
Do you want to beat up Leonard Maltin? Like, if you saw him, would you like want to throw down and punch him in the street? Like these kind of like the fancy dancy movie review people? Like, or would you? Like,
I mean, he would be on that list. I mean, you know, over the years, there was a critic at the New York Times named Janet Maslin who called a lot of these movies, especially horror movies, she called it, you know, hardcore pornography of violence, and really thought that they shouldn't be reviewed and they shouldn't be celebrated. And I was supposed to have a debate with her back in the 80s, but she backed out. But anyway, that was the feeling for many, many years. Now,
right.
when films like Shape of Water are winning the Oscar, you know, it's a monster movie, wins the Academy Award. Obviously, tastes have changed a bit. And when it makes $600 million or whatever the film made, you know, then obviously, you know, we're in a little bit of a different world now.
That's an interesting point. When it comes to the sort of the need to be despised, when it comes to the horror genre now being more mainstreamed, despite the fact they still had the Oscars had the audacity to call Get Out a comedy, and anyone who said that, and I'm not even being like hyperbolic, they should be shot because that is a horror movie. Do you think that there is a danger with the mainstreaming of horror films? Because don't you sort of need those more stuffy people to make it seem cool?
Well, what you need is maverick filmmakers who will go against the grain of the culture. I mean, you need people who will do the incredibly politically incorrect movie. I mean, it's like exploitation film producers are like the professional wrestling business. Mm-hmm. They pick out things that will really annoy a segment of the public, and they emphasize that in their movies.
Right, right. And
so it's different things at different times. But yeah, we don't have enough of those guys who are hustling a buck, you know. A lot of the film school kids, they worship these exploitation movies of the 80s, you know, and so they make really bad ripoffs of exploitation movies from the 80s.
Right.
Because they seem to get the pacing wrong. That's how I always view it. It's especially with the new ones where they kind of emphasize on the very, very slow pace of the old film. So I feel like they think that they are making homages to grindhouse movies by essentially making what ends up being boring movies.
Yeah. I mean, whereas, you know, write something new, write something that scares you today.
I think the last director that I can remember that made a movie in very, very recent memory that truly scared the hell out of me, and I felt icky watching it, was Lars von Trier's The House That Jack Built, because that played on certain tropes like killing children that was really, really intense.
Yeah, you probably do have to go that far these days to really shock the public. There's a movie we have on Shudder called Deathgasm.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's a kind of, if you saw the old movie from the 80s, Trick or Treat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The idea being, what if Tipper, you remember Tipper Gore? Does anybody remember Tipper Gore?
Tipper Gore gave the biggest gift of all time, sort of going back to that previous comment of like having people despise it. That's what makes it cool. Yeah. Tipper Gore was the greatest marketing tool of all time for rap music and for just hardcore music in general.
So she was claiming that, you know, rap music caused, you know, rape and violence and all these bad things. And so, so the premise of Trick or Treat is, what if everything she says is true? Mm. and you play the record backwards and the devil appears and it turns everybody into, you know, demons and rapists and everything. And so there were actually three or four movies of that type. So along comes this movie Deathgasm in 2015 from New Zealand, and it's the same idea 30 years later. And so I'm like, well, is New Zealand just especially slow? They're just finding out that this type of subgenre exists, you know? And I don't know. It's like, it's really well made, but it's sort of, but because it's based on such an old idea that people, it doesn't really, you know, register that well anymore. It's like a movie. It's like a, it's like you don't really fully engage with the movie because you're thinking, you know, why are they doing this in 2015?
Because everybody wants their whack at it. I feel like that's the two. They think that, like, well, now we can tell it our way. But it's like, right. Well, they've done it many, many times.
Yeah. And, you know, the same thing with, you know, if you have a lot of money, you can do a remake. You can pick a mediocre cult movie from the 70s or 80s. Mm-hmm. And remake it.
Well, exactly. Like they did with Maniac and a series of other films that have been come out more recently.
I have been obsessed with remaking The Man with Two Heads. I think that that's got like a good, there's a pocket there about what I always wanted, David Cross and Wesley Snipes.
I would watch that. It's almost like horror is becoming like, you know, Broadway. What do they do on Broadway? They do the same 10 musicals over and over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
They do Gypsy, they do The Music Man, they do, you know, and so we have these stories now, these horror stories that are considered classic, you know, Hellraiser being one of them. How many Hellraisers have there been?
Oh, the new one is rough.
Well, Hellraiser has been around long enough to the point where we got a fat Pinhead, which is crazy. He's not even fat.
I feel represented.
Yes, I know. So where do you draw the line between an homage and just a straight up copy and paste? Like, because homages are great. Like, I love when people give winks to the genre and, you know, just an appreciative nod to the people, the forefathers of horror. But then when it's just a straight up steal, where do you draw the line between homage and just mimicry?
Well, I think there's got to be something reimagined about the original story. Otherwise, what's the point? It's just going to suck. And when they first started remaking, when the big budget era of remakes started, when would they call that? Like the year 2000 or 2002, something like that.
Yeah.
I think the first one was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, yeah, when they made it all pretty.
Yeah, they did the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, then they did The Hills Have Eyes. The Hills Have Eyes remake was pretty good. I mean, because the original Hills Have Eyes was shot on 16mm, and so it's kind of, you know, grainy and weird, and maybe that helps it, maybe it hurts it, I don't know. But the Hills Have Eyes remake, even though it was made by a French dude, which burns me up.
I'm this way. I feel the same way about how many times we've had a British dude play Charles Manson in two different things recently coming up, and it's driving me up the wall. Charles Manson is ours.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anyway, when they were doing those first ones, I thought they were well done. I'll never like a remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's my favorite movie of all time, so I'll never really like it. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with it.
Right.
It was competent. It was, you know, they did their homework.
Yeah.
And then at some point they just became all, you know, cheap and cheesy and quick and dirty and, you had people remaking stuff like The Legend of Boggy Creek. There's movies you just couldn't remake.
I know some just re-released the old one in the theaters because I want the theater experience of going to see the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That would be so freaking badass.
Oh, yeah. And you're seeing a lot of that. A lot of that's happening. A lot of times I'll be asked to come and introduce a movie. And I'll say, how many people in the audience have already seen the movie? And it'll be like 90%. but there's a real desire to like watch movies with other people in a theater, especially if it's 35 millimeter film.
Yeah.
Because that experience is, you know, being lost. As you know, Netflix believes that the future is one person with one device.
When I see people watching movies on their phone, I'm like, "What? Where do you enjoy anything? Do you also just like? Is it only Natty Light? Is that all the only thing that you drink? How do you feel about the new, like, festival kind of ran horror film? Because so now it seems like they kind of set up every year the horror movies that we're going to get. There's some remake. Mm-hmm. There's normally some form of either a sequel or something schlocky that they kind of push to the wayside. But then now we're getting like, we had it with the Hereditary. We had it with Suspiria. These new like festival loving, like high art horror movies that then kind of get paraded around and get a lot of attention, and I enjoy them, but it seems like we're losing some of the fun in the process.
Yeah, they do sort of telegraph which ones we're supposed to like, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think that unfortunately, you know, the only people that get noticed are the ones that do have some bucks.
Right.
And it shouldn't be that way because the technology for making movies has become so cheap I thought we would have like, you know, 100 horror movies a year because, you know, so many people would be able to make one. And I thought, you know, even if just like 5 out of 100 are good, it would be an improvement. But it hasn't really worked out that way because I go to these festivals where the guys with the $20,000 horror film or the $35,000 horror film, and they suck, you know, and they'll say, you know, they'll have a panel afterwards and say, well, you know, we didn't have enough money to do this. And I'll say, you know, guys, nothing involved with the flaws in this movie have anything to do with money. You know, the production values are great. You know, it's the script, it's the acting, it's the, you know, well, we live in Lawrence, Kansas. We don't have any, you know, we don't have professional actors here. Isn't there a university in Lawrence, Kansas? Don't they have a drama department in Lawrence, Kansas? You know, it's like,
right.
Yes, you do. You have actors there. Don't say that.
I feel like people truly forget those resources. I think they forget that, like, Bruce Campbell was his friend. Like, that was Sam Raimi's friend. Like, that was a guy that they knew that was super fun. Everybody that all of my favorite stories of the filmmaking groups that came out of was, like, literally, like, a bunch of school kids that, like, one of them ended up being in all the plays, and the other one ended up getting a camcorder when he was 12 years old and just started shooting everything. And they learned to tell a story over time about what they liked, where now it seems like people are on which I think it is important to copy, but I wonder if they're losing a little bit of that inspiration.
And of course, Henry's friend grew up to be Joe Francis from the Girls Gone Wild series. And my God, what a successful filmmaker.
It started with my tits. I mean, I could sit and talk. I mean, I am shaking. I am vibrating. You don't want to see it. I'm so excited. I could talk to you about movies all day, but I want to ask, obviously, I watched all of, watched all the new drive-ins on Shudder.
Oh, so good.
They're great, man. They are fucking great.
Thanks, man.
I want a couple questions about the process of that show. First of all, congrats. Love the new pickup. Can't wait to see the new show on Shudder. I'm already in. And our listeners are already in.
Right.
My question is, so when the in 2011, like when the last show, when Monster Vision ended, were you just kind of like waiting for another show to show up? Like, was it you're like a thing where eventually somebody will come, like someone will come? Were you actively pitching a show or were you just like, were you ready to be done?
See, I'm originally a writer. And so I just went back to my writing career. You know, I figured, okay, TV is over. I'll go back to writing for magazines. Of course, it wasn't as easy as I thought because, you know, they forget about you and then you have to go and find your old editor friends and get jobs. But I just went back to writing. I wrote a couple of books and I wrote a lot of magazine articles and I did some other writing. And then about once a year, somebody would come to me, either a producer or a network in some cases, and they would say, you want to do a new show? And I would say, sure. Right. And then I would never hear from him again.
No, they just wanted him. They just wanted to.
It's what a great business.
We just want to make sure that he wants it, and then we're not going to give it to him. Very good.
And so that went on for, you know, 17 years. And so these guys came to me in the fall of 2017. Two guys. One of them, his day job was editing for MTV, and the other guy, his day job was producing for Troma. And they said, hey, can we pitch a show with you? And I said, sure. And I figured, okay, we had lunch. That's over.
Another dream down the fucking toilet.
About a month later, they show up with the Shudder executive, and we have lunch. And he says, yeah, let's do the show. And so we started. Actually, it was originally going to be a 54-hour marathon. We were going to do remember the old Jerry Lewis telethons
where
Jerry would get more and more ragged?
Yes. It was all those weird steroids and he started plumping out.
He would become weirdly sentimental and, you know, you were watching it partly to see how psychotic Jerry would get. And so I said, let's do one of those, you know?
Right.
Then they came back to us and said, well, we don't have the money for that. We've only got like $5.
You're like, perfect. I'm your man.
And so I said, well, we've planned this big thing. And they were like, well, we don't have money for that. Here's $5. And so the producers and I were thinking about, well, maybe we should just, you know, put this on hold for a while and walk away. And then the crew, I'll never forget this. The crew says, we'll work for free. We wanted to work on this. We'll work for free.
Wow.
A lot of them. Most of them. And I said, well, fuck, I got to do it now. And so we shot that first 24-hour marathon. You know the reality show Ink Master?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Ink Master is shot in an abandoned factory in a bad part of Newark, New Jersey. And Ink Master had an extra room. So we took over their extra room and kind of recreated the old Monster Vision set. Because that was the other thing. I'm saying to these producers, I said, what kind of show you want to do? And they say, Monster Vision. I want to do Monster Vision. And I'm like, that show's 20 years old. They said, no, that's what we want to do, Monster Vision. I'm saying,
right.
You can't repeat TV. You can't do the same thing you did 20 years ago. That would be like, you know, you can't do the Dick Van Dyke show today.
That would be terrifying. He looks like a skeleton. He's nothing but teeth now.
No, that's what we want to do. We want to do Monster Vision. And so I was like, okay, what about this element? Yeah, we want it to be exactly like it was. So we kind of did exactly the same show. And I didn't really know what we had. And then, as you guys probably know, it caused this sensation.
Yep.
Mostly not because of the quality of the show, but because we took down the servers. You know, everything we broke Shudder that night.
Well, you know, I will say there is something about just feeling, you know, in this world, not to get all like, but everything has gone crazy. Technology came at us so fast. Everyone's like spinning, 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 like we're all in the Gravitron. There is something about just putting a flag in the past and just bringing it to the present. And I think there is something about seeing Joe Bob Briggs presenting films that makes everyone feel like, okay, we can get through all of this. Joe Bob is still with us. We're still rocking and rolling.
Dude, there's just nothing... There's nothing old about the simplicity of the show.
No.
That is always forever fresh. It's you in the camera. I'm already on board with the movie. You showed me a couple of things I had never seen. I actually never saw Terror Train. There's a couple ones I saw, I was just like, okay. There was ones I saw, I was like, this is, oh, hell yeah. This is a perfect excuse to rewatch all the Phantasms. We're going to go through this whole thing. We're gonna revamp this whole thing. Me and my wife sat, and it's like got popcorn.
Well, that's the other thing that I mean, the director of the show, a guy named Austin Jennings, I said, you know, Monster Vision was on a commercial station, and so you know we can't really reproduce it. And he says, oh yeah, we can. We're gonna interrupt the movie. And I said, do you have commercials? No, we don't have commercials, but we're going to have commercial breaks. And so I said, okay, isn't that going to really piss people off? And he was like, well, they can watch the uninterrupted movie elsewhere on the network. And I said, okay, well, you know, we'll do it. And so we did that, and people liked it. They liked going through the movie with a friend, you know?
Exactly.
Dude, that's when I went and I refilled my bowl. I literally would go. That's when I would go. That's you would be time. Talking in the background. I'd pour my drink, did exactly as you ordered, and sat back. It's really good.
Absolutely. Joe Bob, you mentioned how you began as a writer, sort of transitioned into being a television personality. And for those that have not read Joe Bob Goes to the Drive-In and Joe Bob Goes Back to the Drive-In, you must. Your writing is brilliant. Your satire is absolutely brilliant. Is there anything that you wanted people to get from your writing, whether it be sociological, political, that was sort of lost because of the horror genre? So some folks would just say, yeah, that's really smart commentary on modern society, but it's under the guise of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre review or something about, the movie Evil Ed or something like that. Was there anything in your writing that you felt wasn't fully appreciated?
I felt like all of it was not fully appreciated. The thing about us rednecks is you can dismiss anything a redneck says.
Right.
You know, it's like the last minority group that can be absolutely vilified at any time. You know, it's like I think it was Lenny Bruce said, if the Pope spoke with a Southern accent, nobody would believe anything he said.
I agree.
our co-producer, Marcus Parks, is from Rochester, Texas, and he talks about it quite a bit about how like and when we visited Texas, they're like, don't you make fun of our shit here. Like, no, you understand, it's like there's a whole culture here.
It's a huge safe space, the state of Texas, for the Texas or for the redneck personality type.
But I actually have to, because I was sort of an unapologetic redneck, everything I said was easy to dismiss.
Right.
Even if later it was, you know, it was quoted somewhere as saying, hey, this guy actually made a good point here. You know, but right. No, it probably can't be a good point because he's a redneck. So it was always, but that was also kind of the fun of it.
Can I ask you a shock jockey question? When you were writing Profoundly Erotic, would it be a thing that, like, did you have to, like, jerk off first and then get your thoughts clear? Like, is it one of those where you literally had to get the demons out and then you can write?
Well, no, because oddly enough, that was a book about movies that were prosecuted or banned because of the sex in the movies. And remarkably, none of the sex is very good in any of those movies that were banned.
Right.
And so, that was an easy call.
You mentioned sex, which of course you refer to as aardvarking. Which makes it really crosses some strange streams. Where'd you come up with the idea of calling sex aardvarking?
Well, I was first writing these reviews for a mainstream newspaper, and there was a whole host of things you couldn't talk about and you couldn't say. And so I started inventing nonsense words, that were pretty obvious in context what they meant. And so I ended up with my own vocabulary. Now, when I got to TNT, TNT had a very strict standards and practices thing, you know, big list of stuff you couldn't say. And so I instituted the same principle where I would just, you know, invent a nonsense word for whatever I wanted to say. And then my nonsense words started showing up on the forbidden list of words you can't say on TV. So it's you can't ever win. You know, when I first started out, and I would be censored for this, that, or the other, they would always say, "Joe Bob, you can't offend the, you know, I understand it's funny, but it's offensive to the older people," you know. And then now that I'm one of the older people, they'll come along and say, "You can't say that because it's offensive to the younger people."
Right.
What the fuck?
Yeah, dude. Yeah, man. No, it is difficult.
No, and you know what? Both of those are lies. We have found with our show, people are not as easily offended as studio executives want to portray them as. Folks really do have a stronger palate than a lot of people understand.
I do a little thing at the beginning of my show about safe spaces and trigger warnings and make it clear that there will be no safe spaces and there will be no trigger warnings.
Yeah, I know a lot of people in the younger generation hate all of that stuff. So you're doing a good job. That's why they love you.
But that's the beauty of the Shudder show. What I, and this is because you can just let it fly. That was like, mostly it was like when Natalie, my wife, and I were watching him being like, man, he gets to go without a net. Like he gets to just, he could say whatever the hell he wants to say. I have a question about process. When you go through, like when you are going to do the movie, do you do any pre-writing? Like, is there stuff that you know you're going to say, or do you surprise yourself all the time?
No, I kind of know what I'm going to say because, you know, I'm on so many fucking minutes. We interrupt the movie like five times, and I'm on before the movie, I'm on after the movie. Now, thank God, you know, there's a lot of information on most of these films. When I first started doing this, we had films where there was zero information. You know, there was no internet. And so we didn't know sometimes we didn't know what country the film was made in. We'd look up the director. We couldn't find any reference to where he came from or who he was, you know.
Well, I think you can gauge that by how much young boy full frontal nudity there is. Because if there's a lot, that's Sweden. That's for sure.
You really love it.
Actually, if there's a lot, that's Dave Dakota.
I want to tell you my story eventually about how I saw David Cronenberg's butthole in a doctor's office accidentally.
Henry, you know what? Just tell him now.
I was in a Hollywood doctor shooting a series in Canada in Toronto, and they said, "Hey, oh, you can go right in there. You can go right back into the examination room. They're ready for you." And I opened up the door and literally said, "Hi, I'm Henry Zebrowski." And as I opened up the door, I saw a man bent over the table, an older man, bent over the table while the doctor was looking at his rim, like looking at it, like knelt in front of it. And he turned to look at me, and it was David Cronenberg. And I just was like, I'll never be in one of his movies. This is done. This
You've
is
seen
my
too
career
much.
With him.
Yeah. How could you respect it's him terrible. As a director when you know what his butthole looks like?
But so, Joe, so when you just riff, like you don't have a teleprompter, like you just go.
No, I have notes. I have notes.
Okay, cool.
Right.
I know where we're starting, where we're going. Yeah.
Okay. Because no. I riff all the time, and I wonder, like, you're so fucking sharp that I was like, how do you stay that sharp? Like, how do you stay so in the pocket?
What I do is I say, we're not going to stop. Once we start, we're not going to stop. Right. So it creates tension, especially if we have guests. A lot of the guests hate it. Actually, some of the more accomplished actors don't like that at all. they're like, "What? What do you mean?" And they're like, "No, we're not going to stop. This is it. The one time we're going to do it one time, and that's it."
Well, that makes you a true professional.
But 15, well, you know, real like movie acting is 5 minutes at a go. For the most part, you literally have to memorize your six lines in a scene or whatever you do, and then you get that one take of a scene, and then you can move on. The acting is easy. It's all the rest of it is very difficult.
And that's six lines a day.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. We are talking to Joe Bob Briggs. You have got to check out his show on Shudder. Again, Joe Bob's Drive-In Theater. Just a true legend, Monster Vision. Joe, I got a question when it comes to surroundings and horror movies. We were kind of going back to that Netflix conversation, going back to what Henry was talking about with folks watching movies on their phone. The drive-in movie experience, I felt like that was so crucial because we kind of missed out on that. Our generation, I'm 37, Henry's 34 or 35. Our generation didn't really have that drive-in movie experience where they played three movies in a row and maybe one of them is good or maybe half of one of them is good. What do you think about just the setting for the genre of horror, just the surrounding setting of the drive-in experience? Do you think that that was crucial for the genre?
Well, it was crucial not for the reason that you know you were watching the movie outside in a car, but that those drive-ins were owned by independent owners, mom and pop operations, and so there was this great demand for movies that were outside the studio system, because a lot of times the drive-ins, they couldn't afford the big studio movies, or the studios were contemptuous of the drive-ins, didn't want their movies playing there. And so so the drive-ins and the grindhouses were heavily dependent on guys like Roger Corman and Samuel Arkoff and the great indie producers of the 50s, 60s, 70s. Mm-hmm. And 80s. And then what replaced it was the video store during the VHS revolution, certainly in the 80s, where suddenly they just wanted as many titles as they could get. So for guys, for hustlers like, you know, Fred Olen Ray, Jim Wynorski, these directors who were very active in the 80s, that means I can just like make a cheap shot on video movie for, you know, $50,000-$60,000 and it'll just go straight to the video stores. Yeah, I'm down for that. And so they just started churning these things out. And some of our most beloved cult films come from that atmosphere where you came up with the idea for the movie on Monday, you shot it on Tuesday. You got it in the video store on Wednesday.
It's the urgency. It's because you literally had to spit out the movie. You had to you had it inside and you had to.
I have no money. I call up my friends in the business. I say, we're going to shoot this in 6 days, you know, show up in Glendale on Tuesday. And they would, you know, rough out a script and make the movie. And so that kind of, Wild West feeling, it's like, I don't know why we don't have that today, because the technology got so cheap. Those guys were working with 35 millimeter film.
I think it's a mental, I think we're friggin' hypnotized to believe we're helpless. I think that there's a part of it, which is the reason why, because I know when I was first describing to my agent, and we talked about this all the time when we were doing the podcast, right? Because a podcast is now this business where anybody can do it. You could get like a Zoom and a microphone and you got a podcast. You can now pump it out. You have GarageBand, and they're for so long they've been kind of pushing against it, essentially because they can't figure out how to make money off of it.
Well, yeah, we went against the studio system in its own way.
And so I feel like it's almost that there's kind of prevailing sense of helplessness with this idea that you just can't go and make a movie, when in fact you can just get up and make a goddamn movie if you want to, very, very easily.
I think what happens is the guys who are making, you know, extremely cheap movies, the movies are underproduced. They don't go to film school. They don't learn the classic moves. The advantage of shooting on 35 millimeter film is, you know, you've got to get the shot. You've got to get the shot because the film is too expensive. And so when you're working with digital media, you can shoot the scene fucking 30 times. Well, you shouldn't shoot the scene 30 times. You should know how to shoot the scene before you shoot the scene. You know?
Right. And so, well, and I think that's what made something like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre so much fun, because, oh, my God, Marcus's favorite character, Henry, the guy who lights the photo on fire, the guy with the scar on his face.
The hitchhiker.
The hitchhiker. What the hell's his name again?
Ed Neal.
Yes, his character, I just felt like it came across as so organic. I guess it's because of what you were saying, where it doesn't really seem like he's acting. Some people could say, oh, that's bad acting, but I think that was just a great performance on his part to look like a deranged hitchhiker.
Yeah, he actually told me that he had a cousin who was mentally ill. He copied some of the stuff that his cousin did.
He nailed it.
Yeah.
Can I ask, what's some of your favorite modern movies? What have you seen recently that excites you? Like, do you get to, or are you too busy prepping for the show? Like, do you get to go out to movie theaters, or people like, what do you think, Joe, as you're trying to watch it?
Well, I'm not as up on recent movies as I should be. I actually just did my show at South by Southwest, and everybody was chattering about Us. Mm-hmm. And but it was, you know, film festival people are not real people, you know, and right. critics who go to film festivals are not real people.
Right.
And so I would say, what is it about? And they would say, oh, it's about everything.
Perfect.
And is it good? It's so good. I'm not sure what I saw, but it's so good.
So, you
know,
good.
And so I don't know. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know if it's great or awful.
I actually think Jordan Peele is doing some good stuff for the genre, because he is taking it to another audience, and I have no problem with what he's doing. I thought Get Out was really, really good. But going sort of on that question, but sort of the inverse of it, was there a film growing up? Did you really love these grindhouse films when you were growing up, or did it? What came first, the job of writing for them, or the love for them?
Well, I always liked movies, but I would say I discovered exploitation movies when I was, you know, well into my 20s, because they seemed forbidden. And that was the ad campaigns. The ad campaigns made them feel like something you shouldn't be watching. So I had to see them. And, you know, they were either sex or violence. It was always sex or violence. It was some kind of like extreme that you couldn't get in the mainstream movies.
What about the idea, you know, going back to that kind of concept your buddy, Mr. Neil there, when it comes to just having unattractive people on screen, I think, you know, you mentioned rednecks being one of the more maligned groups, and I do agree with that. There's a great documentary on that, as a matter of fact. But when it comes to ugly people, they are not on screen. As a matter of fact, the gal who played Eileen Wuornos, what was her name?
Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron. She got an Oscar for just looking like a normal person.
And they're, you know, like, going, I can't believe even, she dared mess up dare her she? Face like that.
I
oh,
know.
Incredible.
And Elijah Wood, who I actually really like, he's big for our genre, and I have no problem with Elijah Wood. But the fact that Elijah Wood played Maniac, I don't think he should have cast himself in that, because you go and you watch the original Maniac, the guy who played that character, I am fully convinced it was a documentary, because I was like, that guy is so freaking creepy. What about just getting ugly people in front of the camera? How much do you think that makes it controversial?
What, to put an ugly person on camera?
Yeah, because you don't see ugly people on camera anymore. And when a celebrity who looks beautiful dresses up as ugly, they get nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, well, that's sort of. They also get nominated for an Oscar if they play a mentally retarded person.
Yeah,
that's what I'm banking on, Joe. This is what I'm trying to get. That's the kind of role I want. I want to be a simple farm boy that learns the power of love.
I don't think you can judge anything by the Oscars.
But I think that is one of the areas where the horror genre, when it comes to the mentally disabled, when it comes to people who truly look like everyday people like you and I, they were able to say, hey, you can be a star. You can be an actor. We don't have to have this milquetoast version of what we think humanity is supposed to look like. And I don't think the horror genre gets enough credit, really, for being unbelievably liberal and open-minded about putting people who aren't regularly on camera on camera.
Yeah, I would say the best example of that is Sling Blade, where, you know, Billy Bob Thornton, that made him a star. And Billy Bob Thornton wouldn't be a star in anybody's universe if he hadn't made that one movie.
Right.
And so, but yeah, that's
anyway, I guess it wasn't a question. It was more of me screaming into the microphone, making
you're just yelling at us, Kessel. You're literally just yelling at two people on the phone, but, talking to a legend and your best friend.
But I do think that that's an important thing that the horror movie genre has provided us.
Can I ask a dumb, another Chris Farley-esque from the SNL sketch, like when he talks to Paul McCartney, like question? What was Joe Spinell like? Did you ever meet him?
I never met Joe, but I met all his friends. There used to be these character actors that would meet once a week at a restaurant on Melrose Avenue, and they would occasionally invite me to their spaghetti dinners. And it was all the tough guys in Hollywood, and they loved Joe Spinell. And when Joe Spinell died, they made this Joe Spinell highlight tape that they just loved, and they would give it to everybody of all Joe Spinell's greatest moments in film. And so I never met the man himself, but I know that he was just idolized by his fellow character actors.
Nice.
Yeah, he seemed like a wild one, dude. I also love The Last Horror Show. He's great in it.
Yeah, and if you remember, he was the dispatcher in Taxi Driver.
Oh, no. Nice.
He has like two scenes, but he steals the scenes. He's great.
He's great.
Very nice. Well, I guess, you know, just, I mean, I have like one more question, which is basically just movie recommendations. Do you have anything, Henry? Is there any other questions that we have for the legend that is Joe Bob Briggs?
I mean, I could talk like this for hours with you, Joe, but I am not a beautiful woman. There's no reason I would waste your time.
We literally are a WWE tag team coming in at a combined weight of 569 pounds. Yes, I don't think that Mr. Briggs needs to be spending all of his day with us. So, Joe, just finally for my final little question is, what do you recommend? What should the kids go if they want to get into the great horror genre, the exploitation films, where do you start on this journey? Because it is there is a large catalog, and it can be kind of overwhelming, where you're like, what movie should I click on first? What movie should we click on first to go down the road?
I would have to say, you know, because I talked to so many of the fans, that the fans consider let me just put it this way. The young fans consider the 80s the golden age of horror. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the older fans consider the 30s the golden age of horror. The universal monsters. You know, they're like, you know, older guys will tell you, no, there's nothing ever like the universal monsters, you know. And but I think the beginning of modern horror is Night of the Living Dead in 1967.
Awesome.
There had been, you know, up until 1967, there had been like four zombie movies in all of film history, you know, four or five.
Right.
And then George Romero makes Night of the Living Dead, and within about, and then Sam Raimi makes The Evil Dead a few years later, and then we have like, suddenly we have 400 zombie movies.
Right.
So I would go back to the basics and watch that one, you know, for people who are just, you know, all they know about zombies is Walking Dead.
Right, and brains.
This
yeah.
is great, dude. I can't wait for the new series. We got, so March 29th at 9 p.m., so our show's coming out tomorrow. So we'll pump it. So you're 9 p.m. and it goes live at 9 p.m.?
It goes live at 9 p.m. This Friday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific. And, it's going to be double features every week.
Awesome, I will be there.
Thank you so much again, Joe Bob Briggs, a true legend in the horror film genre. Thank you so much for being with us and speaking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Live from your grave.
All right, there it was, the famous legend Joe Bob Briggs. I thought that interview was freaking fantastic. I didn't realize we have to go all the way back to the 1930s to watch the OG horror films, and I have to fully admit, I don't think I've seen one of them.
There's a couple of really fucking good ones. There's Coffin Joe that's really great. I love Dracula. And Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein are fucking perfect.
So what happened with Coffin Joe? Did he work in the mines, and was it whooping cough or a series of different kinds of ailments? Was it
Kissel?
Asthma?
Kissel, don't let anyone ever tell you lost it, because you still got it. You are number one.
You can't lose what you don't got. Am I right?
It is just perfect quotes from
perfect
you,
humor.
My friend.
Perfect humor. Seriously perfect.
Oh, right. God. You got to just live, man.
I know that.
You got to live. Let's just leave it at that. You got to live. And you got to laugh.
Uh-huh.
Because who fucking cares if you're frowning?
Right.
Nobody.
No one
really
cares.
They don't. Even if they should, even if you got a technical problem and you wish people, someone would reach out
right.
and help you if you're frowning, a lot of times they fucking don't.
They don't. Nope.
All right. And you got to love. You got to love with that tongue first. You know what
nope.
I mean?
Do
because
do however
the penis
you guys
gives
want to
up
do
early.
All right, everyone. Thank you all so much for listening. And again, such a wonderful time on tour. We can't wait to see everybody out there. And we are excited for this year's tour. You can find it on my Instagram. I got a little Insta post on there at Ben Kissel 1. You can find it on our website. Come on out. Don't forget, we're in Vancouver, Stockholm, and Berlin. So get those tickets because they are going to be going at a good, moderate pace. Not too fast, not too slow. We don't want to give the tickets a heart attack. But please,
I cannot wait to come to fucking Europe. Cannot wait. Cannot wait.
I get so many DMs from people being like, hey, I'm sorry, we were late to get the tickets. Can you please get us on a compliment? I can't. We don't have that power. So please, Lord, just get the tickets. As soon as you hear they go on sale, just be like, click, 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 and then just do it. Because I don't want anyone to be disappointed. Okay, everyone, thank you all so much for listening. Hail yourselves!
Hail Satan.
Magustalations?
Hail me, please, if you would.
We shall talk to you soon. Your pretty face is going to hell. When's it coming out?
May 3rd, midnight. We're doing it. Let's go.
May 3rd, midnight. Talk to y'all soon.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.